Welcome back to Run the List, a medical education podcast in partnership with McGraw-Hill Medical. Our hosts are Dr. Naveen Kumar, Dr. Walker Redd, Dr. Emily Gutowski, Dr. Joyce Au, and myself, Blake Smith. As a quick disclaimer, this podcast is meant for informational and educational purposes only and should not be understood as medical advice under any circumstances.
Welcome again to Run the List. My name is Joyce Au, and I'm excited to host a few of the next episodes in our renal series. I'm even more excited to have as our guest expert today, Dr. Alexis A.C. Gomez. She went to medical school at UPenn. She did internal medicine and pediatrics residency at Baylor, and she's now a second-year med-peds nephrology fellow at Mass General Brigham and Boston Children's Hospital. She loves taking care of adolescents. She loves all things kidney-related. She enjoys medical education, especially at the medical student level. And in all of the free time that she has when she's not doing work-related things, she loves watching bad reality television. Dr. Gomez, welcome to our show. We're so excited to have you here.
Thank you guys for having me. I'm excited to be here today.
As many of our listeners know, we always start with a case. So today I'm going to tell you about Ms. B, who is a 67-year-old female. She has a history of hypertension, diabetes, breast cancer status post-mastectomy, as well as a recent COVID infection that was diagnosed 1 week prior. She initially presented to urgent care with worsening shortness of breath and fevers, nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea, as well as poor PO intake. She was found to have a sodium of 114 from a normal sodium 3 weeks before in clinic, and her home medications include lisinopril and hydrochlorothiazide for hypertension, metformin for diabetes, and Paxlovid, which was started 4 days prior. She's told to present to the emergency department and is admitted to the medical ICU for close monitoring and management of her hyponatremia. The admitting intern overnight pages renal at 3 a.m. She says, quote, "Dr. Gomez, help. Her sodium is 114. What should we do in this case?" Dr. Gomez, when you get paged like this, even before you think through the diagnostics of hyponatremia, what are your initial safety concerns? What do you think about?
So with any case of hyponatremia, which we define as a serum sodium less than 135 milliequivalents per liter, the first things I want to know are there any signs and symptoms? So those would include nausea, headache, lethargy, altered mental status, seizures, things like that. And the second thing I want to know is if this is acute or chronic. And this is really important for hyponatremia, and the definition of acute and chronic in this case are very different than our typical definitions. So I'll often hear people say it's relatively acute because there is a normal sodium that's been documented a few weeks ago. But for hyponatremia, unfortunately, that's just not recent enough. Acute very specifically means this drop in sodium has occurred in the last 48 hours and it has to be documented. If the duration is unknown, we should consider it chronic because the risk of overcorrection is high. With hyponatremia, the more severe it is, and importantly, the more acute it is, the higher the risk of the complications from the hyponatremia itself. Whereas with chronic, we worry more about the complications from overcorrection. So if someone comes in with a very low sodium and relatively few or no symptoms, you should have a higher suspicion that this is chronic. Here, the risks we think of from the hyponatremia itself are cerebral edema, which in extreme cases can lead to herniation and seizures. So that's why initially I want to know about any neurologic symptoms, including headaches, altered mental status, obtundation, seizures, or anything of that nature. So if they're seizing or altered, regardless of the chronicity, you'll want to give them a bolus of hypertonic, meaning 3% saline. For this, I'd typically give 100 cc's of 3% saline over roughly 10 minutes. This can be repeated every 10 minutes if needed, typically up to 3 times total. The goal should be to raise the sodium roughly 2 to 3 milliequivalents per liter, but we can raise it up to 4 to 6 milliequivalents per liter based on the severity of symptoms. Even this small rise in sodium should be enough to improve the symptoms. But it is important to remember that 6 milliequivalents per liter, as we'll discuss later, is our total goal over 24 hours. So once you hit that goal, you'll want to keep their serum sodium steady there for the rest of those first 24 hours.
Excellent. Dr. Gomez, it sounds like upfront you want to first inquire about symptoms and also think about the chronicity of the hyponatremia. And then once that's tucked away, you start thinking about your diagnostic framework. I hear that oftentimes the first thing you want to do is confirm whether it's real versus pseudo-hyponatremia. Can you just tell us a little bit more about what are some of the causes of pseudo-hyponatremia and how they come about?
Like you mentioned, the first step is to measure a serum osmolality to determine if it is true or hypoosmolar hyponatremia. So if you have a serum osm of less than 275 milliosms per kilogram, it would be considered a hypoosmolar hyponatremia, or what we often call true hyponatremia. If the serum osm is 275 to 290, this would be considered normal. And if it's greater than 290, this would be hyperosmolar. The first case, or true hyponatremia, we'll dive more into in the rest of this podcast. But if you have a normal or high serum osmolality, there's other things that you need to consider. If you have a normal serum osmolality, you'll want to consider causes of pseudohyponatremia. And this is due to the way we typically measure serum sodium concentration. Typically, we make the assumption that around 7% of your plasma volume is made up of proteins and lipids. And the lab measures the sodium content in the total plasma volume, but reports to us the sodium content in plasma water, which is the other 93%. So if there's hyperlipidemia or hyperparaproteinemia, and therefore this accounts for more than 7% of the plasma volume, the sodium they report out, which is the estimation based on that assumption, will be low, even though the sodium concentration in the plasma water is in reality normal. So in other words, if you have abnormally high lipids or proteins, the serum sodium concentration that gets reported will be low, even though your serum sodium concentration is normal. The other interesting case is hyperglycemia, which often gets grouped in with these as not true hyponatremia, but it's actually a little different in the way that it works. With hyperglycemia, you can get a normal or elevated serum osmolality, and people will often calculate a corrected serum sodium based on the glucose concentration. But here, unlike the cases of pseudohyponatremia from high proteins or lipids that we just discussed, there is a true hyponatremia in the sense that it is not from a measurement error. What has happened here instead is that water has moved out of the cells due to the high glucose creating a hypertonic environment in the extracellular space. And this movement of water drives down the sodium concentration. The reason that we often separate this out from, quote, true hyponatremia, even though it is a true hyponatremia in the sense that there's no measurement error, the sodium concentration really is low, is because with hypoosmolar hyponatremia, water moves into the cells, whereas in this case, water moves out of the cells. Because of this, we don't expect the same risks from overcorrection, which we'll discuss later. So in this case, when we correct the sodium for the glucose, it's to try and figure out if you have an additional abnormality in the sodium beyond what is caused by the hyperglycemia alone.
All right, so it sounds like there's a few causes that can throw you off on something that isn't quite hyponatremia. There's the causes of pseudohyponatremia, which includes high proteins or high lipids. And then there's hyperglycemia, which also impacts how you think about the hyponatremia. So once you confirm that based on the serum osms, the hyponatremia is actually a true hypoosmolar hyponatremia, what do you do next from a diagnostic standpoint?
Yeah, so after confirming that you have a true hypoosmolar hyponatremia, people will often divide the causes by volume status. So this is where you have your hypovolemic patients, euvolemic, or hypervolemic. Although this is commonly the way we're taught in medical school, I actually prefer to divide up our diagnostic framework by what the kidney's doing, as I find this to be more objective, and the kidney is the center of my universe. So my first step is a good history and medication reconciliation to help me start thinking of my differential, as well as a urine osmolality and urine electrolytes, meaning sodium and potassium, to start to get a picture of whether or not there is ADH secretion and if the kidney is in a sodium avid state or not. To do this, I'll look at the urine osmolality first. If it is less than 100, this typically makes us think of excess water intake relative to solute intake. So just as background, for anyone, the amount of urine you generate in a day is going to be based on the solute you take in and therefore the solute that you need to excrete. So let's pick some easy numbers just to help us think about this. If you take in 600 milliosms a day and your urine concentration is 300 milliosms per liter, you generate 2 liters of urine to get rid of the 600 milliosms you took in. So if you drink 3 liters that day, your sodium will go down, because you will have taken in 1 more liter of free water compared to what you excreted. Of course, you also need to take into account other water losses, solute generation, etc. So the math can get more complicated than that. But I think that's a good starting place to think about what causes hyponatremia with a low urine osmolality. The things you should think of in this bucket are psychogenic polydipsia, meaning drinking too much water, a tea and toast diet, so very low solute intake, and beer potomania, which is a combination of high fluid intake and low solute intake. In all of these cases, you're taking in more fluid than the volume of urine you're generating to get rid of your daily solute load. Next, we'll take a look at our patients who are secreting ADH, meaning their urine osmolality is greater than 1 to 200. If this is the case, I'll look at a combination of the urine sodium and the patient's volume status. So here, the number I typically remember is a urine sodium of 20 milliequivalents per liter. If the urine sodium is less than 20 milliequivalents per liter, it means that RAS is activated and the kidney is trying to hold on to sodium. If the urine sodium is greater than 20, it means there's some reason that the kidney is not holding on to sodium, and we'll want to think about what that could be. So first, we think about our hypovolemic patients. If they have a low urine sodium, it means that RAS is activated and the kidney is responding appropriately. So you have extra renal losses causing your hypovolemia, such as diarrhea. If your urine sodium is high, you should think about what can be causing the urinary sodium loss despite hypovolemia. So this would include things like your thiazide diuretics or hypoaldosteronism. Next, we have our hypervolemic patients. These patients will often have a low urine sodium due to their decreased effective circulating volume. So these are our patients with CHF, cirrhosis, and sometimes our nephrotic syndrome patients. However, they can also have a high urine sodium if they're on diuretics to help manage these conditions, which they often are. And lastly, we have our euvolemic patients. These patients most commonly are going to have a high urine sodium and are our patients with SIADH. Of course, in each of these buckets, there are a few other more rare causes, but these are the main ones to consider.
Dr. Gomez, thank you so much for walking through this framework. You mentioned medications previously, specifically diuretics that can impact sodium excretion. I have a hard time sometimes thinking about which medications do this. Can you talk through which common medications in particular can impact sodium balance and specifically how they work?
Absolutely. So the first thing is there are so many medications that can impact your sodium balance. It would be impossible to list them all in this podcast today. But the big ones that we want to think about are thiazide diuretics and your SIADH-inducing medications. So thiazide diuretics are a very common cause of hyponatremia, and you should really think about this, especially in your elderly patients and women. So generally, thiazide diuretics work by inhibiting your sodium chloride cotransporters in the distal convoluted tubule. When you impair this ability to reabsorb sodium here, you can't maximally dilute your urine. Or, put another way, thiazide diuretics impair your free water excretion. Holding onto free water means driving down your sodium. On top of that, you're in a mildly volume depleted state, so you'll typically release ADH. You still have your medullary concentration gradient intact, so you reabsorb water. And again, this all leads to hyponatremia. There are some more complicated ways that thiazides can cause hyponatremia, but I think that's beyond the scope of what we should touch on today. However, this overall mechanism is important because it means that with a thiazide-induced hyponatremia, you can typically expect a high urine osm and a high urine sodium, which can make it look like an SIADH-type picture. The other big classes of medications we should be looking for are those that cause SIADH. Although there are many medications that can do this, your big classes to think about here are antidepressants, anticonvulsants, and antipsychotics. And relevant to this case, ACE inhibitors are also known to cause SIADH. Again, here, the specifics about how each of these cause this are, I think, beyond the scope of today. But generally, while many of these medications are thought to increase ADH release, certain medications may also cause SIADH by other mechanisms, such as increasing renal sensitivity to normal plasma ADH concentrations. Generally, though, if I'm uncertain if a patient's medication or medications can cause SIADH, I'll pause here to do a more thorough literature review.
That's wonderful. I think remembering that we can always search something on UpToDate or Google something is always helpful in these particular cases when people come in on 20 different medications have hyponatremia of in a non-certain origin, and that can really help us sort through the causes of their hyponatremia. So I'll talk through a case update now for Ms. B. So on further history, Ms. B reports that she stopped eating because she had this loss of appetite due to her COVID and admitted to drinking about 6 liters worth of tea a day because she had profuse diarrhea as well as some vomiting after she started her Paxlovid. On initial testing, she had a low serum osm confirming a true hyponatremia and then had urine osms of 117 and a urine sodium of 31. Can you apply the diagnostic framework you just talked us through to this case?
So this is a really interesting case, and there's a lot of different things that could be going on here. So we'll go to our diagnostic approach that we talked about. So first, we've now confirmed that she has a hypoosmolar hyponatremia, so we'll look at the urine osm and the urine sodium.
If the patient has water intoxication, but they're not hypovolemic, I would not expect them to be secreting ADH. And so our urine osmolality would be low.
So that's typically our first branch point. If the urine osmolality is high, so greater than 1 to 200, it means she's secreting ADH, and we'd be more suspicious of either hypovolemia or SIADH. Then, if the urine sodium is less than 20, meaning RAS is activated, or put in other words, the kidney is sodium avid, then I typically would consider this appropriate ADH activation, leading me to believe this patient is hypovolemic. However, if the urine sodium is greater than 20, as it is in this case, my suspicion typically would be that this is more consistent with SIADH. So in this case, when we think about it, our urine osm is greater than 100, so ADH is being secreted at least to some extent. Next, our urine sodium is greater than 20, so normally, if we go to that diagnostic framework, this would make us think of SIADH. But this case is tricky, because it's important to remember that she's on hydrochlorothiazide, so we can't rule out that this urine sodium may just be the effect of the thiazide. And lastly, it's important to remember that in the hierarchy of things that keep you alive, blood pressure is more important than sodium. So this means if you're hypovolemic with a low serum sodium, the hypovolemia remains a potent stimulator of ADH release despite your hyponatremia. And the kidney will continue to respond to this and reabsorb water as we need to preserve blood pressure and perfusion. So this could also be a contributing factor to our patient's hyponatremia, especially with her significant fluid intake. So in this case, there could be a lot of different things that are going on. So with her loss of appetite, her nausea, her vomiting, and the diuretics that she's on, certainly she could be hypovolemic. She may also have some ADH secretion from her nausea and vomiting, which is actually one of the most potent stimulators of ADH secretion. She's on lisinopril, which can contribute and cause SIADH, and she has significant water and tea intake relative to her solute intake. So this is certainly not a straightforward case at all, and I would think that any and all of these things can be contributing.
Dr. Gomez, thank you so much for walking us through this case. I think one of the things that I'll always remember is that you'd wish that there were a single cause hyponatremia, but typically things tend to be multifactorial, particularly in this one. Next, can you talk us through how then you approach treatment once you have a sense of what might be causing the hyponatremia?
Yes. So the first step whenever we're treating a case of hyponatremia is to think about what our target sodium is. So typically, I'll aim for 6 mL equivalents per liter in the first 24 hours and no more than that. So my goal here would be 120, 24 hours from the time that we had the 114 mL equivalents per liter documented. If we have a case that is symptomatic or acute, it is important to remember that although our goal is no more than 6 mL equivalents per liter in 24 hours, we can safely raise it those 6 mL equivalents early in those 24 hours, as long as we hold it there. This is particularly important in cases like we discussed above, where we may need to address symptomatic hyponatremia to reduce the risk from cerebral edema. However, we always need to balance that with our risk of rapid overcorrection, especially in chronic hyponatremia, where we run the risk of causing osmotic demyelination if we raise the sodium too quickly. The next step after we determine our goal is to look back at our etiology. So again, our typical teaching in medical school is to treat the underlying cause, but it's important to think about cases like this where it may be somewhat unclear, that could be multifactorial based on our history, and our studies may be misleading because of the medications that they're on or other confounding factors. This case in particular is an interesting one because the studies may lead you to think that this is SIADH, and it certainly could be, but it could also be hypovolemia with a higher than expected urine sodium from our thiazide. She could have the SIADH from lisinopril. You could have ADH release from the nausea and vomiting, and there certainly could be a component of how much tea that she's taking in. So while there's a risk of overcorrection no matter what, the patients that I personally worry the most about are the hypovolemic patients. This is because if we give them fluids and correct the hypovolemia, they can lose their stimulus to secrete ADH. Without this ADH causing them to hold on to water, they can start to have significant urine output and water loss in a very short amount of time, and this can lead to overcorrection. So this is where you'll find some variability in practice among nephrologists or other physicians. Some will focus on the underlying cause, meaning they'll give fluids like NS or LR if they're concerned about hypovolemia, or if they're concerned about SIADH, they may start a fluid restriction and possibly give salt tablets or urea packets, as well as remove the offending medication if there is one and if it's possible. You can increase solute intake if there's concern for a tea or toast diet, and if the patient is hypervolemic, you can give loop diuretics. For me personally, when I suspect SIADH, I'll do the second approach, meaning fluid restriction and urea packets, especially if I'm certain about the diagnosis of SIADH and if the hyponatremia is mild to moderate, meaning that my serum sodium is greater than 120 milliequivalents per liter. However, like you mentioned, it's often very unclear what the etiology is, or perhaps more specifically, the etiology is likely multifactorial. So if the hyponatremia is severe, meaning less than 120, or if I am uncertain about the diagnosis, as in this case, I prefer to do what we call a DDAVP clamp and hypertonic saline. The hypertonic saline, which is 3% in these cases, can either be done as a drip that is adjusted or as boluses, depending on personal preference and hospital policy.
Great. I want to ask more about the DDAVP clamp in just a second, but you mentioned something that I don't think we oftentimes use that often, which is the urea packets. Can you tell me a little bit more about how urea packets work and why they might be helpful?
So urea packets actually work in a similar way to salt tablets, and I'll use one or the other just depending on either hospital policy, what they have in stock, and what it may be easier for the patient to get as an outpatient if I think that they'll still need the therapy as an outpatient. So urea packets work similarly or work in the same way, and basically what it is that you're giving the patient solute. So if you go back to our math before, if you're giving the patient urea packets, that then becomes solute that they have to excrete. And so you can help them to excrete free water, bringing your sodium up when it's done in conjunction with a fluid restriction.
That's wonderful. I really have never seen it before, so it's really helpful to hear how you use it in other places. Now, you mentioned the DDAVP clamp that I want to ask you about. Can you tell me more about DDAVP clamps? Do you do it for everybody? When do you use it? How do you approach using DDAVP?
Remember that DDAVP is a synthetic vasopressin analog. So when we give DDAVP, we're essentially giving them exogenous ADH. If the hyponatremia is severe, I'll typically opt for a DDAVP clamp and hypertonic saline unless I think the patient is hypervolemic. Even if there's evidence that they're producing their own ADH when you start, meaning that their urine osmolality is high or they're not producing a large amount of urine, if the stimulus for ADH is removed by giving volume, the overcorrection can be incredibly rapid, and you do not want to run that risk, as this can cause osmotic demyelination, as we mentioned before. Even in patients who are significantly volume deplete, a very small amount of fluid, even just 250 cc's, can shut off their natural stimulus for ADH. And I've seen patients who are given even this small amount who begin to produce liters of urine an hour, and it leads to rapid overcorrection. So by giving DDAVP at the beginning, we in effect clamp the urine output at a lower urine output and the urine osms at a higher level. So if their natural stimulus for ADH is shut off, the risk of overcorrection is much lower since we're effectively giving it to them exogenously. I'll personally give it IV every 8 hours, and I'll do it for as long as I'm giving the hypertonic saline. But again, you'll find some practice variation here. Some will give it until the sodium is above 120, some until it's above 130, and others somewhere in between. But certainly you want to make sure you're out of the severe hyponatremia range. After that, you can adjust your treatment based on the underlying etiology, as well as each patient's individual risk of osmotic demyelination, as certain patients are at higher risk than others. One thing I always like to remind people of as well is that you can, and probably should, recheck the urine studies as you work to correct things to see if anything has changed. So for example, did you start off with a low urine sodium and now it's high because you fixed the hypovolemic component, but they're still on a medicine or have another condition that causes ongoing ADH release? Or now that you've stopped the thiazide, is your urine sodium low and you can know that you're dealing with hypovolemia? This will help you adjust your plan day by day as you need to and see how the kidney is responding to the changes that you're making.
Wonderful. So I'll now share a case update with Ms. B. So with Ms. B, we did a DDAVP clamp for the first 2 days with hypertonic saline and actually corrected exactly 6 milliequivalents per day. So she hit 120 on day one, 126 on day two, then 134 on day three. We did allow her to eat, but we did give her a 1.5 liter fluid restriction to prevent rapid overcorrection. On clinic follow-up a few weeks later, her sodium actually remained stable at 134, which we were happy to hear about. Before we wrap up this episode, Dr. Gomez, can you share a few pearls for our listeners to walk away with?
Absolutely. So I think the biggest things to remember with hyponatremia are start by assessing for signs and symptoms and figure out if it's acute versus chronic. And remember, acute is a documented drop within 48 hours. All else, including if you're uncertain, should be treated as chronic. Confirm that it is hypotonic hyponatremia and send those urine studies off right away to help know what you're dealing with, along with taking a good history and doing a medication reconciliation. And lastly, if the hyponatremia is severe or you are uncertain about the etiology, unless the patient is hypervolemic, I'd be reaching for the DDAVP clamp and hypertonic saline to reduce your risk of overcorrection.
Wonderful. Dr. Gomez, thank you so much for joining us today for this episode on hyponatremia. We're really excited to have you share with us your wisdom on hypernatremia as well as acid-base disorders in the upcoming episodes. And so, Dr. Gomez, thank you again. We will see you next time.
That sounds great.